for those that survived, there may be very little grazing pasture and uncontaminated water supplies left.
Tonga is still working to recover from violent volcanic blast. It's Monday, January 24th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, lessons learned from Tonga. COVID spreading amid India's big crowds. U.S. efforts to thwart an invasion. Abortion rights at risk. Space challenges. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Efforts to aid the tens of thousands of people affected by Tonga's disastrous volcanic eruption are beginning to gather momentum, with the first arrivals of aid by plane and boat from New Zealand and Australia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The full scope of damage and needs is still unknown. However, humanitarian agencies say about 87% of the South Pacific Islands' 100,000 people have been affected by the volcanic ash and tsunami triggered by the underwater eruption. Assessments of the damage from government and international sources are slowly trickling in. They find the biggest priorities to be that of restoring telephone and internet links, as well as the provision of safe drinking water for about half of the population. The World Food Program warns of potential food shortages because all agricultural sectors have been badly affected, from crops to livestock and fisheries. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says initial estimates show up to 12,000 agricultural families have been affected.
Roughly 60 to 70% of livestock-rearing families are estimated to have been affected. Given the enormity of the eruption, it is likely most families could do nothing to protect or save their livestock from perishing. And for those that survived, there may be very little grazing pasture and uncontaminated water supplies left.
While a large-scale aid operation is finally getting underway, the United Nations warns the volcano is still active and Tonga is not yet out of danger. Another concern is that Tonga, which is free of COVID-19, remains so and not have the coronavirus enter the country during the delivery of aid. The spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says the first rule of humanitarian action is to do no harm. He says very strict protocols are in place to prevent that from happening. He says all agencies will abide by what he calls a no-contact delivery.
The pilots staying in the cockpit, a ground crew of local folks unloading the plane, and the pilots taking off without exiting the plane. It can also be a ship's going to port and being offloaded by cranes. So also so that the ship crew do not actually get into the island.
The World Health Organization says all medical and healthcare facilities on the island are operational. It notes the air is toxic because of the ash and dust raised by the volcanic eruption, and says it is urging people on the island to stay indoors and wear masks when they venture out. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our social media updates on Twitter and Facebook. Stay with VOA Asia. We have more on Tonga after this. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Seoul says it paid Iran's delinquent United Nations dues to restore vote. Myanmar court sentences two prominent activists to death. Humanitarian aid tops agenda as Taliban meet Western officials. Game-changer e-moped batteries spread from Taiwan across Asia. Sherpa siblings aim for Explorers Grand Slam. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and so much more. Visit us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and our website, voanews.com. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Tonga's low death toll may be a result of a long-established culture of community and mutual accountability. But disaster response experts also say there are lessons yet to learn for the kingdom. Suzanne Varislum is the president of the East-West Center and recently spoke about the issues the island nation is facing with VOA Asia's Jessica Stone.
This is something that the people of Tonga are not new to, right? They are aware of where they live and the things that come, the good and the bad that comes with that. But what measures do people in that region take to mitigate these types of natural disasters?
In terms of preparedness, we can see that, you know, we've had the number of three deaths so far, and we haven't had the full assessment, damage assessment yet. But those initial numbers tell us something about the culture and the organization of the communities within Tonga and many of our Pacific Island nations, where the unofficial structures of family and chiefs within villages and those community responsibilities are clear in helping to save lives, to distribute aid, to make sure that everyone is taken care of. I think that's unique to the Pacific Islands. So that preparation is certainly there. And also, many of these Pacific Islands have tried to network with one another. We've seen the relationships that they have with the neighboring Pacific Islands, as well as New Zealand and Australia. So those kinds of long-term relationships, and of course, Samoa and American Samoa, that's right in their neighborhood as well. And we here in Hawaii, we all are interconnected. And realizing that, there have been some initiatives taken, partnerships with the University of Hawaii here in Honolulu, where many of their disaster management leaders, which are small, have really come here to learn for several weeks about the normal traditional disaster response process that we know around the globe, but integrated also in the way that their cultural structures are set up in their communities.
This undersea communication cable, right, that was cut by the explosion, and that certainly has made it difficult to get help, to get an idea of what's going on the ground. What is the lesson learned that Tonga should do differently from a communications vantage point?
I think that Tonga has seen what has happened as a result of the cutting of the cable and the reliance on the cable, that they have to look at different methods. Increased number of satellite communications dispersed among the 36 islands that are inhabited, and perhaps other high-frequency radio systems that are point-to-point to islands, so that the main island in can have a situational awareness and how to respond locally before external help can come in.
There was a campaign telling people to cover their rainwater tanks to protect them from the ash, and that worked. Could they be better prepared in that respect for clean water, since that's been the biggest need in the short term?
Water is essential, especially right now, clean water, and in the long term, when we look at the long-term impacts of what has happened or what will happen with ash in the air on in catchment systems, et cetera. And I think that will be a long-term study. I think, you know, having New Zealand respond right away with desalination capabilities on their ships, I think is key. But I think it shows us that they have to look deeply, and I think they are, in terms of what kinds of new technologies can be introduced to provide that locally already on site should something like this happen again.
Any other big pros and cons of the natural disaster response that you want to point out for us?
I want to say that, you know, as we're looking at short term, you know, it showed us how very important it is to have a process for damage assessment, how important partnerships are. And we saw the response right away from, again, New Zealand and Australia, and Japan has now offered, in the United States and globally. But having systems in place locally, I think the cultural system that Tonga has, I think we will soon see light shone upon the process that they have in these communities. Should something like that happen in a built-up area or in places that are don't have as tight-knit of a community, I think the response would be very different. I think we can all learn about localized resiliency campaigns and building resiliencies in communities. So I think the world has much to learn about the way in which Tonga has approached their community support for vulnerable populations, helping one another.
Suzanne Varis-Lum, president of the East-West Center, speaking with VOA Asia's Jessica Stone. Still ahead on VOA Asia, mass gatherings in India are leading to mass COVID infections. Happening now in Asia, Malaysia's anti-corruption czar has sued a local journalist for defamation over articles questioning the legality of his past shareholdings in a case seen by some as a bellwether and a test of the country's rule of law. Rights groups point to a shrinking space for the free press and growing harassment of journalists. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's great to have you with us today as we begin the week together on VOA Asia. Curbs have been imposed in India's cities as a third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic sweeps the country. Health experts, however, are flagging mass gatherings, such as religious festivals held in North India, they fear could turn into super spreader events in the world's second worst affected country. Anjana Pasricha has a report from New Delhi.
This holy dip in the Ganges River is a ritual many Hindus believe will wash away their sins. For the thousands of devotees taking part in a religious pilgrimage in the northern city of Prayagraj, their faith overrides worries India is in a third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
I have no fears. I think this disease belongs to the past.
As devotees pour in, authorities say they are taking precautions, allowing only those who are vaccinated. Some priests even spread the message of safety.
We are following COVID-19 rules. We got tested, took vaccines and are following all protocols. I appeal to people to be careful in order to put an end to this disease from the world.
The crowds at such festivals, which also have taken place in other cities, make it difficult to enforce COVID norms. Many pilgrims don't wear masks. The Omicron variant is causing fewer hospitalizations. But as infections surge to an 8-month high, doctors urge caution in a country whose medical infrastructure was crushed last year.
This time, till now, we are in a comfortable level, but we have seen what is happening in US, what is happening in the Western world. They are getting concerned, their beds are full. So obviously we cannot be complacent.
Cities such as Delhi have been partly shuttered, but mass gatherings elsewhere raise worries the pandemic could continue to cause pain.
Practically speaking, social distancing is not possible in such places. So it is best if we close such premises only for a certain period.
People should be more vigilant. I see lots and lots of people without masks.
Health experts warn that similar religious gatherings and political rallies had fueled a deadly second wave last year. The Omicron variant is even more transmissible.
If you have gatherings with all the non-COVID behavior happening, it is going to be the super spreader events. So all these religious rallies and the political rallies have to come to a halt. There's no doubt about that. And if we continue with it, then we are in for trouble again, like the second wave. But if we can control these things and people have a COVID appropriate behavior, maybe that the numbers won't be so high.
As India gears for elections in 5 states, a temporary ban has been imposed on political rallies that caused concerns earlier this month. But this pilgrimage will continue for 6 more weeks. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Thousands of Buddhist monks have gathered in central Seoul, South Korea, to protest what they say is religious discrimination by the government, spurred by anti-Buddhist remarks by a lawmaker of the governing party. You'll find this in all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We have more on VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met for 90 minutes with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva amid high tensions over Russian troops and military equipment massed along Ukraine's borders, a situation that may have implications for Asia. Blinken told reporters the diplomatic process will continue. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
As Russia continues its massive military buildup of at least 100,000 troops and heavy military equipment along its border with Ukraine, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met Friday in Geneva with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in another attempt to try to defuse tensions.
This was not negotiation, but a candid exchange of concerns and ideas. I made clear to Minister Lavrov that there are certain issues and fundamental principles that the United States and our partners and allies are committed to defend. That includes those that would impede the sovereign right of the Ukrainian people to write their own future. There is no trade space there.
Blinken said the U.S. would send written answers to Moscow's security concerns, as Russia had requested, but reiterated that the U.S. and allies were prepared to impose a severe penalty if Russia moves forward with an invasion. Lavrov had this take on Friday's talks.
I cannot say whether or not we are on the right track. We'll know when we get a written American answer to all the points of our proposals.
Blinken had this message for Russia.
I suggested to Minister Lavrov, as we have repeatedly, that if Russia wants to begin to convince the world that it has no aggressive intent toward Ukraine, a very good place to start would be by de-escalating, by bringing back, removing its forces from Ukraine's borders, as well as engaging in diplomacy and dialogue, which is what we did today.
Henry Hale, a political science professor at the George Washington University, told VOA the decision on whether to invade Ukraine comes down to one person, Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Well, the big problem is we don't really know what Putin wants, and the nature of Russia's political system is such that even the foreign minister of Russia may not know what it is that he is actually representing.
Hale told VOA that with the world watching, Putin is clearly engaged in brinksmanship, and that is inherently risky. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, China State Television CCTV reports immigration officers at a cordoned-off zone of Beijing's Capital International Airport are under top-level protection as they receive foreign athletes and officials for the Winter Olympics that begin in early February. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the U.S. Supreme Court decision establishing a woman's right to have an abortion was handed down on January 22, 1973. Now, 49 years later, that landmark ruling is under threat, as is access to abortion in multiple states across the United States. VOA's Laurel Bowman has the latest.
Emboldened anti-abortion activists march on Washington on the eve of the 49th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court ruling in Roe v. Wade, which established a woman's right to choose an abortion.
Do you believe that the unborn person should have the right to life? If you do, let me hear you say yes.
The White House marked the occasion by calling for improving women's access to abortions during a time of new legal challenges.
This is a moment for us to recommit to strengthening access to critical reproductive health care, defending the constitutional right established by Roe, and protecting the freedom of all people to build their own future.
Psaki referred to the Supreme Court's decision not to intervene in a new Texas law that bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, even in cases of rape and incest. It also allows private citizens to file a lawsuit against anyone who performs an abortion. The new restrictions come after Republicans complained for years that abortion laws have been too lax.
The U.S., of course, is currently an outlier in the international community. We are ranked right up there with North Korea and China as one of the most permissive countries in the world when it comes to elective abortion.
In fact, abortion is legal in most of Europe and other highly developed countries. In December, the U.S. Supreme Court considered a Mississippi state law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The restrictions in the Mississippi law defy the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling that abortion must be permitted up to the point when a fetus becomes viable. So, by defending its law, Mississippi is in effect asking the court to overturn Roe v. Wade.
I think abortion is kind of barbaric. It's an old practice. Abortion has been failing women and families for over 50 years.
On the other side are those who feel that women have the right to end pregnancies without government interference.
It's about politicians controlling women's bodies. It's about politicians taking away the personal decision of people to access the health care that they need.
I've never had an abortion myself, but there is a chance that I might need one day, and this is just about abortion justice and liberating abortion.
In the Mississippi case, abortion opponents are counting on the Supreme Court's 6-3 conservative majority to deliver them a long-sought victory. The Supreme Court will announce its decision this year. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
A blood disorder, once considered a temporary condition for space travelers, now seems to be a primary condition. Plus, Earth just recorded its 6th hottest year on record, and a pair of cosmonauts spacewalk outside the International Space Station. VOA's Arash Arabisadi brings us news from space.
The pair of spacewalking cosmonauts outside the International Space Station. Oleg Novitsky and Anton Shklaplerov spent 7.5 hours installing handrails, antennas, a TV camera, and docking targets on the Pre-Shaw module that docked with the ISS in November. Elsewhere, a study finds that spaceflight may pose health risks to anyone spending time beyond Earth's gravity.
We thought we knew about space anemia, and we did not. We had assumed that this was a very quick phenomenon of adaptation and nothing was going on. And now we're discovering that's not the case. Space has a primary specific effect on red blood cell regulation.
Anemia is a red blood cell deficiency, which makes it harder for our bodies to move oxygen. The study says the body normally destroys and replaces 2 million red blood cells per second, but Trudell's team found astronauts' bodies destroy 3 million every second during a 6-month stay on the ISS. A trip to Mars would take much longer, and Trudell says that raises more questions.
There's a knowledge gap here that we need to fill in terms of the mechanism, in terms of the countermeasures, in terms also of the planning of the mission. So will we need some blood products or artificial blood products on board the mission to Mars, given the fact that there is destruction ongoing? Would we need iron supplements at one point if we can't recycle all of the iron to make new red blood cells?
Trudell says weightlessness in space makes having fewer blood cells less of a problem, but landing on Earth or other planets, anemia could affect energy, endurance, and strength. The Canadian Space Agency funded the study that focused on 14 astronauts, and while it didn't examine space tourists, Trudell says the microgravity they experience likely triggers space anemia as well. Finally, more bad climate news for our home planet. NASA and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, released reports showing 2021 as the 6th hottest year on record and the last 8 years as the hottest ever recorded. Experts say hotter temperatures mean more extreme weather events like heat waves and floods. The report shows global temperatures are up more than 1 degree Celsius, and while it's too soon to be sure, the data hint at an acceleration in temperature rise that could get much worse if temperatures keep climbing as they have the past 40 years. Arash Arabisadi, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Check us out online. Find us at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We thank you for joining us, and we thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Keith Lane, Chris Casquejo, and Jessica Stone. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.